I don't think there's any doubt that we're in a precious metals bull market. You know, people say, well, I'm going to get involved, but when there's confirmation? Well, there's confirmation. Precious metals bull markets always start with the fear buyer. They always start with physical precious metals. When you and I first really started visiting consistently was 2023. And there was a lot of skepticism presented by your listeners saying gold is moving, but the gold stocks aren't moving. Why is that? Well, there were two reasons. Gold was moving because foreign central banks were buying it. And foreign central banks don't buy gold stocks. So an asset class that had buyers was going up, and an asset class that didn't wasn't going up. Gold stocks don't move until the increase in the selling price of their product generates greater free cash flow margins. Free cash flow margins are exploding at the big companies, and hence their share prices are exploding. This is indicative of the fact that we're only 25 or 30% of the way through the precious metals bull market. It's important that people understand that.
Rick Rule, good morning to you. Good afternoon to me, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well, Andy. The better for being on, having a conversation with you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And it's always not only an honor, but I always have a lot of fun and there's a lot of stimulation when we talk. Quickly, or not really quickly, one of the things I want to talk on is I last saw you just over a month ago in Boca Raton at the symposium. To all my viewers and listeners, I met a lot of you there in person, and it was absolutely fantastic, Rick. I'll tell you a couple of stories, but before I tell you those stories, I want to talk with you about that. How did you pull it off? How did it go? And what have you learned from it?
Well, we pulled off a good 4 days by working 12 months. We took 3 days off after this year's conference. And then after that, we began work on next year's conference. One of the things that we learned is that in a 4-day conference, you don't have enough time to teach all the lessons you need to teach. And one of the things we do is that we begin the conference 6 months before the start date by interviewing all of the exhibitors and all of the speakers so that the attendees arrive at my conference already prepared to allocate their time better than they otherwise would. And we work after the conference too. As you know, the recordings of the conference are available after the recordings, after the conference, pardon me. It is impossible, physically impossible, for somebody to attend 55 hours of programming over 4 days and take it all home. The recordings, whether you attended live or via live stream, are timeless. They're good information. And if you don't play the recordings after the conference, you are missing probably 50% of the value of the conference. It's important that people know that. Now, having put on the conference for almost 30 years, there is a core of attendees who understand that that 4 days is illusory, that they have to spend 20 or 30 hours before the conference getting ready for it, and they have to spend 30 or 40 hours after the conference utilizing the lessons that they learned at the conference. I think it's precisely that. I think it's precisely because I don't have to stand at the podium anymore and say, take notes, that the audience has been conditioned to take notes. And that many of them have been taught how to do securities analysis at the Rule Classroom, that makes that community so useful to people.
Yeah. Before I move on, and I want to tell you a couple of stories, and then I want to hear what you've learned as far as anything specifically what you learned, but how can people take advantage of you and the Rule Classroom? Where do they go? And are you still evaluating portfolios?
Yeah, three ways to interface me. The easiest and the cheapest, free, is to go to the Rule Investment Media website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, and list your natural resource stocks. I will, for no obligation, rank your companies 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have value. Please, as a note, no crypto, no tech stocks, no psilocybin or marijuana stocks. I don't do those things, literally or figuratively. I do natural resource stocks. The second thing I do, which is also free, is you can join me in the Rule Classroom. There are 14,000 regular members of the Rule Classroom. who benefit from, as an example, a 6.5-hour short course called Introduction to Natural Resource Investing, and over 200 hours of instructional programming. Most Thursdays, I do a live Q&A there about any natural resource topic that you want to do. But remember that there are 14,000 other people to talk to in the chats, many of whom are engineers, geologists, or CEOs of mining and oil and gas companies.
Got it. So what's one thing that you didn't realize that you knew before going into the conference, and then just one thing that you picked up during the conference? It could be macro, it could be micro, whatever, but what's the biggest thing, one thing that you learned?
I didn't have very many surprises this time because I was prepared, having already interviewed every one of the exhibitors. The change I noticed was the change in attitude among attendees. I was very pleased in 2024 with the engagement between attendees and the speakers, between attendees themselves, and between attendees and exhibitors. What changed this year was in 2024, people were skeptical. They were aggressive, but they were skeptical. They came to learn. This year, they came to invest. aggression by which well-prepared, well-schooled attendees digested the information from the exhibitors. You could literally watch stock move during the conference, and I haven't seen that before. What I was also struck by is when I was talking to individual investors who were investing, they were investing actively, but prudently. It was a very, very, very good circumstance. I asked somebody, you know, what they bought, and I asked them why, and I really liked the why, which was great. I mean, it was absolutely great. I would say that the second positive surprise I received was the sense of community that's developing between the attendees, both online and live. One of the things that's always struck me, Andy, is the expectation of the crowd at the beginning that all of the knowledge is going to flow from the dais to the assembly, which is ridiculous. Between live and online, there's 2,000 people attending. There is a lot more community knowledge in the community than there was on the dais. And we're just now, I think after 30 years, learning how to facilitate the communication between attendees, which will really magnify the conference. I'd say the third thing that we're doing, you're a manifestation of. The way that information is distributed and conversations are originated is much less with formal media now and much more with social media. We had 40 social media participants there. The social media participants' job, from my point of view, is to amplify the message of the conference to their own congregations. Social media participants did a wonderful job promoting the conference for us. More importantly, they facilitated all of the conversations at the conference to those who, for various reasons, couldn't participate. I suspect that the conference will generate 10 or 15 million page views in addition to the 2,000 people who attended live or live stream. So those would be the key differences.
Yeah, if I can comment a little bit about that. I was there at the conference in 24, and I thought it was great energy. 25 is just like a wave of energy, just significantly even more amplified. And I was really taken aback by that and surprised. I actually spoke to 25 of the companies that were attending there. I believe you had 50, so I spoke to half of them. That's all I could fit in. And they said the same thing, the amount of just sheer energy and engagement that they were getting from the audience was absolutely surprising to them and like they've never seen. The second thing I want to comment on is I brought this up to you several times. 30 years ago, I attended a different conference and I met you and I followed you around at a puppy dog. This conference, I met Sean Rosen, I hope I get that name right, who is just a titan and a pioneer. And I met Rob McEwen, both in person. And they were very, very professional and businesslike, but also exceptionally gracious to me. And it reminded me of you 30 years ago. I could not be more pleased with their level engagement with me. And I had nothing to offer them. So just a shout out to Sean Rusin and Rob McEwen.
What I've noticed is that the living legends, the people who have built multi-billion dollar mining companies from scratch, by the way, we always try to have five or six of them there.
Yeah.
Are very focused, very hardworking people. They want to talk about their companies. They understand that your audience ranks in the thousands and they can't talk to those people individually, but they can use you to talk to that audience. And as you probably noted, they don't want to talk about baseball. They don't want to talk about popular culture. They want to talk about their companies. That's one of the reasons why Sean Rusin came out with a press release today saying that between the capital that they raised, $175 million in the funding commitments, that they've now raised all the funds to put Caribou into production. It's because Sean Rusin, who, by the way, has made hundreds of millions of dollars, is a nonstop worker. You know, he's an absolute nonstop worker. And to him, talking to you wasn't a task. It was a pleasure. You wanted to talk to him about the most important thing in his life. And he wanted to tell you his story.
Yeah, that is so true. And boy, did they, both him and Rob. So I couldn't be more pleased and happier. And I guess a shout out to all of my listeners and viewers. I met a lot of them there. And take advantage of this next year and just really pick a few of the living legends, meet them, and do a lot of due diligence before the conference on different companies. So you have a list, if you would. Speaking of which, you mentioned that stock was moving during the conference. Yes, it was. I had a list and some of them, I didn't want to chase. And right. Some of them were out of reach within the second or third day there.
Well, that's really important, Andy. And we should talk about that for people who are going to come next year. The furor engendered by the conference in terms of the immediate buying probably dissipates in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So if a company is 50 cents at the beginning of the conference, maybe you overpay a little. Maybe you pay 54. But what you do is you enter a good till cancel limit order. The stock can move to 65 or 70 as a consequence of the conference. But often over 6 or 7 weeks, it eases off. There's no particular point in overpaying. You don't have to do that. Prices are set on the balance between supply and demand at the moment.
Yes.
So it's important. When I see something at the conference that causes me to want to buy, I always use good till cancel limit orders. I don't want to compete. The second thing, and you didn't see this as well because these people are fairly quiet, but there were at least six family offices there, and four of them are natural resource family offices. And so there was actually several billion dollars in deployable capital contained in six different teams, composed of about 13 individuals, geologists, engineers, analysts, and stuff like that. We look at an audience like that and we think, okay, like doctor, accountant, you know, whatever. Yes, that's all true. But there was also some very quiet, but extraordinarily large, sophisticated money there.
Yeah. No, there was. And I live in that crowd, if you would. And I spotted many of those people. It's like different faces, but the same kind of person, people that you might spot. So let's talk about this. And again, well done. Fantastic. Well done. What I'm really curious about is your thoughts going into the end of the year here. What are they? And I have my own thoughts that I'm happy to share with you here. Give me yours.
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any doubt that we're in a precious metals bull market. People say, well, I'm going to get involved, but when there's confirmation, well, there's confirmation. Precious metals bull markets always start with the fear buyer. They always start with physical precious metals. When you and I first really started visiting consistently was 2023. And there was a lot of skepticism presented by your listeners saying gold is moving, but the gold stocks aren't moving. Why is that? Well, there were two reasons. Gold was moving because foreign central banks were buying it. And foreign central banks don't buy gold stocks. So an asset class that had buyers was going up, and an asset class that didn't wasn't going up. Gold stocks don't move until the increase in the selling price of their product generates greater free cash flow margins. Free cash flow margins are exploding at the big companies, and hence their share prices are exploding. This is indicative of the fact that we're only 25 or 30% of the way through the precious metals bull market. It's important that people understand that. But you don't have to wait for it to start to occur because it's occurring right in front of you in real time. What happens is that as the biggest and the best companies attract premium valuations relative to the rest of the sector, value investors, myself included, begin to go farther down the quality trail looking for valuation discrepancies. And if the valuation discrepancies don't get arbitraged away by investors like myself, the big companies with a lower cost of capital take over the little companies. That's what happens. And we're going to see that.
We are seeing that.
I happen to believe, because of the arithmetic that you and I have described around the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar, that this gold bull market has much longer legs than people think it does. When I ask myself what will cause me to sell gold, it'll be when the reasons to sell gold go away. When we have a political solution to $100 trillion in off-balance sheet liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. When we have a balanced budget. When we have a positive real interest rate. I believe that the best prologue to what we're looking at right now is the decade of the 1970s. In the decade of the 1970s, the U.S. dollar lost 75% of its purchasing power, and the gold price went up 30-fold. I think over the next 10 years, the U.S. dollar is going to lose 75% of its purchasing power again. The gold price is already up 12-fold since the year 2000, so I don't think a 30-fold increase is in the offing. But it wouldn't surprise me at all to see the nominal gold price increase in a fashion that mirrors the deterioration in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. If that does happen, the bull market that we're in now is going to be one for the record books. Truly one for the record books. By the way, I hope I'm wrong about the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. I really hope that young people don't go through the reckoning that we went through in the decade of the 1970s. It was ugly. High unemployment, high interest rates, the so-called misery index was ugly. I just don't believe that you can endure the profligacy that our society has endured in the period 1982 to 2022 without a reckoning. I don't understand how the math works.
Right.
So although I hope I'm wrong, I think I'm right. And if I'm right, judicious investments in precious metals and natural resources should hold somebody in very, very, very good stead through the next 10 years.
Yeah. You know, use the word a lot, hope, and I hope you're wrong as well, but I don't think you're wrong. You know, I learned something from the great Jim Rogers. He once told me hope is a terrible strategy to have. Yep. You don't invest on hope. Talk to me about one sector, and I have a sector in mind, but I want to see what you have to say. And some of these companies were represented at the conference. One sector that you really, really like, and one of them that I was told, and who was it, is one of the titans there told me. But anyways, what's one sector that you really like here that is somewhat not being discovered or known yet, or you think has much higher to go other than gold?
The sector that I'm making the allocations to is not a commodity sector. I'm attracted to deposits that are held by juniors that have $15 to $20 billion in in situ recoverable reserves, irrespective of the commodity, where usually the commodity's out of favor. Usually it's in a country that people are uncomfortable with. Usually it's 4 or 5 years away from production, which is to say a tier one deposit that has no bids. That's what I love. I have a lot of money invested in very high quality resource stocks. And I don't need to make 10 baggers or 20 baggers or 30 baggers, but I like it. And so a tier one deposit is defined by me as a deposit with at least $10 billion in in-situ recoverable reserves and resources at today's commodity price. But I'm greedy, so I prefer $20 billion to $10 billion. It's a deposit that you think, were it put in production today, would be in the best cost quartile worldwide in the commodity that it produces, and in the best quartile worldwide in terms of return on capital employed, but at least 25%. That's really, really, really the crux of what I'm doing with my own money right now. There is an Australian listed company that has an amazing mineral sands deposit in Malawi. It would be the first or second largest rutile deposit in the world, probably the largest graphite deposit in the world. You know, people say, rutile, graphite, I want gold, I want copper. Malawi, I can't spell Malawi. This is going to take forever. I want to make the money by Thanksgiving, you know? So I like that sort of thing. There's a different company that has a sulfide nickel deposit. People hate sulfide nickel because the latter rates are so cheap. In Brazil, they don't like that, I guess, because the people are brown or speak Portuguese or something. Again, $20 billion in in-situ recoverable reserves and resources. A separate company exploring in Brazil with a large PGM deposit. It was cheaper last year. PGMs are up. With the overprint of what might be an iron oxide copper gold discovery. The fourth is a rare earths company, Australian listed company, which is also in Brazil. The sector that I love are companies with large resources that are hated. Hated.
Yep. So I was going to ask you, is there a jurisdiction you wouldn't go to? Because you're saying your places that are out of favor, if you would. But I think a better question is, you've listed or you talked about, and I know some of these companies you're talking about, I think I know them, but you are mentioned a couple of Australian companies.
Yep.
Do you see money flowing more? And this is a different question, money flowing more to Australian companies as opposed to Vancouver companies because of regulations or just because of the way they're set up? And I've heard other words. Okay, go ahead.
The Australian equity markets, we're starved for capital for 25 years compared to the Canadian markets. The consequence of that is that the Australian geos, the Australian promoters, were more attracted to the concept of using capital markets to make discoveries, while the Canadians were more attracted to promotion, using stories to mine the capital markets. There was a much more direct relationship between rocks and money in Australia. So I would suggest that there was a better corporate culture among the juniors. There is an unfortunate tendency among Australians, which is declining, to be extremely xenophobic. In bad markets, the Australian investor seems to regard everybody who lives outside of Australia, even if they live in New Zealand, as a wog, you know? And so they sell off in bear markets non-Australian assets with reckless abandon. So for 40 years in bear markets, I've always looked for high-quality Australian juniors that attract hate in their home market. It makes perfect sense that Australian companies would be less attractive to North American investors than Canadian companies because we've been schooled to look at Canadian companies. It also makes perfect sense that Australian companies that have assets that are domiciled in Malawi or Brazil would be less attractive both to American investors and to Australian investors. So it's important to understand the origin of the apathy around the issuer. To me, all of those negatives are positives because they explain to me why a stock is cheap. It's not that I'm making a valuation error. It's that the market is very inefficient at stories that aren't wrapped up in a way that's convenient to the listener.
Yeah. So one of the issues that, well, I want to say issues, I wanted to get your feedback on it. Maybe you can change my mind. Australian stocks have so many shares outstanding, and I really look at share structure. Does that, and that bothers me, to be very frank with you. Where does that?
It should. It should, by the way.
Okay, so help me overcome that then when I'm looking at an Australian company that has a billion or 2 billion shares outstanding, or I'm looking at a U.S. company or a Vancouver company that has 100,000 or 100 million shares outstanding.
The smaller count, share count is more efficient because the spread between the bid and the ask in percentage terms is always lower.
Okay.
One of the reasons why the Australian dealers prefer a billion shares out with a 10 cent to 11 cent bid ask spread is because they get the spread. You roll that stock back 10 to 1 and it's selling for a buck. The spread between the bid and the ask may be a buck to a buck two, which is to say 2% rather than 10%. The dealers, the Australian dealers, like dealers everywhere, have a bad bone. Often when I finance an Australian junior, when I participate in an equity offering there, I make it contingent on a 10 to 1 rollback.
Really?
Precisely so that I can increase the trading efficiency that I'll enjoy and my customers, my subscribers will enjoy in the aftermarket.
Yeah. Okay. That's great advice. Now, do you mind buying on the Australian markets or do you prefer buying on the U.S. over-the-counter markets?
I go wherever it's cheaper. if you,
right?
I use Interactive Brokers, which has a very... very clunky interface if you're an old man like me. It requires more technological sophistication than I have. So I wrestle with Interactive Brokers. But you can instruct Interactive Brokers to go for best ask. In other words, you can ask them to correct for currency transaction and decide whether the Australian stock is cheaper in the U.S. over-the-counter market or in Australia. Mm-hmm. In private placements, I prefer Australia. In the U.S., the hold period for a private placement is a minimum of 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, it's 24 hours. I prefer to have unrestricted stock in 24 hours as opposed to 365 days.
To all my viewers and listeners, this just made your year if you picked up on that nugget of information right there. Thank you. Okay. Last question, really. Is there a place you won't go? I asked some of the legends at the conference the same question. I didn't get a chance to ask you. And I'll tell you first before you answer that, my opinion, I'll just go about anywhere, just about as long as I'm compensated for my risk. What's your answer?
Well, that's consistent with my experience. I've enjoyed great success in South Sudan during the war. Great success in Congo during the war. Spectacular success for 23 years in Russia till it was over. And I would go back to Russia in a flash, except I have a banking organization and an American doing business in a sanctioned company. When he or she has a banking organization, it's a pretty stupid thing to do. I have had no success in India, India being at once extraordinarily corrupt and also extraordinarily sophisticated.
Bad combination.
I've done a lot of business with Indians, but for their protection and mine, we've done that business in the United Arab Emirates rather than in India. I've had only limited success in Nigeria for the same reason. It's an extraordinarily corrupt, extraordinarily political culture. I've done a lot of business, in particular with Igbo people. Nigerian people outside of Nigeria. I have a high, high, high regard for that ethnic group. But it's been difficult for me to do business in Nigeria. I have had challenges doing business in the People's Republic of China, where the assets were in the People's Republic of China. I've done it 4 times. And that has been challenging. I've been treated extraordinarily fairly twice, and somewhat less fairly the other 2 times. But, you know, when I compare the results I've obtained from all of these questionable countries with the results I've obtained from the state I was born in, the People's Republic of California, I need to say for myself that my worst experience with regards to political risk was easily California, much worse than Congo.
I've heard the same thing. I have not invested in California, but I've heard a handful of people that I have the highest amount of respect have told me they would not invest anymore in natural resource stocks in California.
Right.
You know,
I'm one of those. I cut my teeth in the California oil and gas business. No more, you know, no more. In the mining business, the same thing. There are people who are sophisticated enough to wade through the political morass of California. But I don't particularly believe in trying to run the 100-yard dash with a millstone, you know?
Yeah. Got it. My last question is, I think I know how you're going to answer it, but just all of the politics, not to get too specific on a party or anything like that, but all the politics, whether it's domestic or it's geopolitical, it seems like there's a lot of unknown and making investors afraid. How are you handling that? And I would say that's probably a good thing because it makes certain assets cheaper and makes the assets that I love go up. But how would you deal with that, the geopolitics of the world right now?
Well, there's a lot to be afraid of. And to the extent that you're able, you need to divorce yourself from as many of those risks as you can. One of the things I do, Andy, and I've done it since the year 2000, is I maintain an alternative ledger myself where I value my income and my expenses and the value of my assets and the value of my debts in gold. And if you save in gold, you'll be surprised how cheap things are in gold terms. Housing prices, they've declined. Energy prices, they've declined. Groceries, they've declined. Now, I also maintain liquidity in U.S. dollars. I do that. But I save in gold. And I would suggest that people consider doing the same. You also need to maintain more liquidity than you might otherwise maintain. Thinking about the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar, that's because if you have one of these periodic liquidity squeezes, where people lose confidence simultaneously, having liquidity when other people don't is extremely convenient. The best investment year of my career was 2009, coming out of the liquidity squeeze of 2008, having both the cash and the courage to take advantage of that circumstance, as opposed to being taken advantage of. Don't look for your government to help you. Think about how you can protect your government, yourself from your government. People your age and my age need to look at the government's promises as lies. The net present value of entitlement promises, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, federal pensions, military pensions, exceeds, according to the Congressional Budget Office, $100 trillion. There's no way that can be paid.
Right.
There is no way that can be paid. Now, I don't think they're going to default in an honest sense. I don't think that they're going to send a letter to some old codger named Rick Rule, say you're old, fat, lazy, and rich, so we're not going to give you any more money. You know, this old fat codger votes on occasion, rarely. But I think they're going to default dishonestly. Mm-hmm. I think that they are going to allow the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar to decline. Or force it to decline if nothing else happens, so that 10 years from now, it takes $4,000 to buy what $1,000 buys today. If you take the net present value of this obligation, $100 trillion, and you devalue the real obligation to $25,000, $25 trillion, and you use an inflation index inflator that's the CPI at 2.5% rather than the real rate of deterioration of the U.S. dollar, which is 8 or 10%. but you don't index your tax to inflation, you see how the government's going to take care of the problem. And you need to defend yourself from that. You need to envision a retirement where entitlements are a very small part of your entitlement income. And you need to organize your life as somebody your age very differently than somebody my age had to organize our life. My generation, you know, for all of the wonderful wealth we created, we also voted ourselves all kinds of really cool benefits, and we forgot to pay for them. We left the debt with y'all. And be mad about it or don't, that doesn't matter to me, but prepare for it.
Yeah. Excellent. So I think we'll end on that, Rick. I just want to thank you so much for, again, spending some time with me as we do every few, several weeks. And just, I want to thank you so much for inviting me to your conference. The symposium was just out of this world. Fantastic. And I'm so looking forward to doing it again next year and having a great time, but also just doing, spending a lot of time with great people. And that's mostly the attendees, which I say mostly because I spent a lot of time with the attendees and they're absolutely fantastic.
Well, the attendees are fantastic. You know, it's a wonderful community. It will, God willing, be much larger and much better next year. We work 12 months for that to be the most valuable 4 days of your year.
Well, it was with mine that I didn't think you guys could beat 24. I made a lot of money off of the conference at 24. And I think 25 is going to even be better. So again, you have my highest amount of thanks.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you so much.